Hello and welcome to the Barton Legal Podcast. I'm Bill Barton, a solicitor who lives and breathes construction and engineering law. At Barton Legal, we help clients in the UK and around the world on everything from litigation and arbitration to drafting and negotiating contracts. And in this podcast, we unpack the latest legal trends and problems facing the industry, providing you with straight-talking insights to help break down these complex legal questions. So, let's get on with today's episode. Hi everybody, I'm Bill Barton and welcome to another episode of the Barton Legal Podcast. Today I'm phenomenally happy and proud to be able to introduce and be joined by Larry Bagel, who from America. I met last year through a beautiful introduction by Paul Darling KC. Larry had come over with the California Lawyers Association for a trip to London, and I was lucky enough to be introduced by Paul and sort of helped out a bit with that trip. With Paul's sad passing, I've stayed involved and doing a bit more, and Larry is such an incredible live wire, positive guy, and just, you're just a huge, you know, positive forward moving force of law that you see no obstacle as being too big. You take on everything with a really positive attitude. I love the fact that we've met a number of different people with you, but you always have a real go-getting and you make people feel positive. I think it's a lovely thing. So, Larry, as I intimated to you, do you think you can introduce yourself in sort of a minute? I always ask the guests just because I think it's interesting to hear in your words how you sort of introduce yourself, and then we'll meander off into different country lanes and things like that.
Well, first, Bill, that was a nice introduction itself. I feel very complimented to hear that from you, and the respect goes back the other way for sure, even across the pond. My name is Larry Bagel, even though it's Lawrence, but I go by Larry, and I always have. And I think what you described in terms of my personality is really the fact that I'm a trial lawyer, and the people that I deal with basically are juries. Besides, of course, my clients and everyone else that in the legal world. And so, one of the things that you try to do with the jury is to be courteous, to be persuasive, to be enthusiastic, and to be committed. And those are things that are, I've developed over the years. I think it was part of me. I don't think I had to work at it. I'm basically a very happy individual. I am married to a wonderful woman. I live in a wonderful part of the world, and I have been lucky enough to be a lawyer, to be a California lawyer, and to be involved in a program that brought us together, actually, as you've just indicated. It's something called a Legal Week in London that is now in its 38th iteration, and it is a wonderful program that I've literally fall in love with, and I can't really quite pull myself away from. So,
well, I hope you don't. And we're going to come on to your time in London, but first of all, I don't have any sort of preset questions, because I think the idea of the podcast, as I said to you, is just to have a chat as if you're at a cafe or a pub, and it's introducing people
podcast. I'll take the pub, Bill.
Good man.
Thank you.
To people I know, to show that as lawyers, we're more dynamic, we're more diverse than people think or presume. And if you look at the range of people that if you slightly put yourself out that you can meet, there's just no end to the level of introductions. But so I'll start, and it might be a question you're asked a lot, I don't know. So you call yourself Larry. Why did your parents call you Lawrence?
Never once in my mind do I recall my wonderful two parents ever calling me anything other than Larry. I think they were committed to that name, but they understood that the derivation of the name is from Lawrence. And I've liked to have said that they were prescient because they spelled it L-A-W as opposed to L-A-U. And so off we went. My mother claimed, and I think, again, I don't have a recollection of this, but I can't argue it. She claimed that I cried incessantly, and she couldn't wait for me to stop crying. And then the problem was I started talking, and I wouldn't stop. So,
and then she wished you were crying.
Then I think she had some regrets.
So so they always called you Larry. My given name is William, and only my family call me William. Everyone else calls me Bill, and obviously myself. And I've been lucky to come through life being, I've hardly ever met another William, and therefore very few Bills. But it's strange how my sister, one of her daughters, she wanted to call her Helen with an H. But because they live in Essex, where they mispronounce things, she knew that Helen would only be shortened to Ellen. So she called her daughter Ellen. So I always find it sort of interesting where parents can see the name's going to be shortened and just give in and use that name. And like you and I, we both have a different name from the one we use on a day-to-day basis. So we started out in some sort of unreal situation. You say you're very lucky. You are indeed to have lived, grown up and worked in California. I asked you this when we met, but it's good to ask you on the podcast. So which has your career been more like, the Lincoln Lawyer or Ally McBeal?
Well, I'm not a big Ally McBeal fan, but I'll have to choose the Lincoln Lawyer mainly because I started my career as a public defender in Los Angeles County. And, you know, I was given cases. And most of those cases looked very, very dingy, if you will. In other words, there was hardly a chance that you could prevail. And I was in a setting where there was no plea bargaining. All that plea bargaining had gone by the wayside. It had not worked to any degree to settle the case. So the case was going to trial. And we were funneled these cases. We got the investigation reports. We got the police reports. And there was no question, Larry, you're going to trial, whether you like it or not. And I will tell you that kind of force feeding was the greatest introduction into trial lawyering that any person could possibly have. Because I guarantee you that some of those cases actually turned tail and all of a sudden had a positive result. And it taught me something. It taught me to be, and I don't think I'm a fearless person, by the way. I've got my own, you know, set of bugaboos. But as far as going to trial is concerned, I've never been afraid of going to trial because in those days, all of that fright was melted away under the orders of my boss who said, you're going to trial. And I learned fearlessness that way. And so now when I've, over the years, moved from specifically just doing criminal law, crimes, as you say, in England, to civil law, where I do a lot of civil litigation, much different. But I got to tell you, no case I've ever had in the civil range has ever looked as bad to me as some of those early cases that I started with. So it's like it was not a tunnel I was in anymore. There was plenty of light at the end. And so these cases have always seemed not more interesting, don't get me wrong, but a little bit less daunting.
I think you're right. It's good in a way to have a limited choice because it helps you to focus. And it means that instead of stressing, you just got to get on with it. I hate going to trial. And not just from a, I mean, I did have an instance many years ago where the day before an arbitration, 3-day arbitration hearing, my counsel just refused to attend. And so I had to attend the next morning. And they said, oh, you know, you can report your counsel to the bar. And I said, yeah, I'm just not going to do that. There's reasons. But yeah, so I had to actually, having thought I was being, you know, the solicitor sitting behind, to actually do all the oral hearing. And that scared the living daylights out of me, you know, that over that night, not preparing. But, you know, you get through. I think it teaches you that there are only 24 hours in a day. It doesn't matter how bad it looks, the day will end. But what I dislike about trial, and interesting your take on it, is I hate the lack of control. You see, I don't mind litigation, but I love drafting because I can draft almost anything. And I think if you tell me, I can find the words. But you get to trial and your witnesses cannot play ball. You know, you get a judge that's a bit quirky. I just hate the lack of control over the whole proceedings. And yeah. So how do you cope with that?
Well, first of all, let me give you one anecdote just because I remember this so distinctly. When the first trial I was in, and I was, serviceably nervous, and some testimony was coming in, which in my mind, I knew quickly was hearsay, inadmissible, but I had to connect my mind with my mouth. And I had been doing that all my life, I thought, but boy, was that hard to, get that word out. Your Honor, I object. This evidence is hearsay and therefore is inadmissible. But I was ultimately able to do that. And I think that was the floodgates opened up. So that was a good start. I'm not so, I think I see trials as a drama, and there's a beginning, there's a middle, there's an end, there's a moral, I'm not worried about the control. What I always worry about is not being prepared enough so that anything that happens during that trial, I cannot, I need to be able to react to. And so preparation to me, I had a high school teacher who famously said, and I'm sure he plagiarized this someplace, prior preparation precludes poor performance. Vern Kelsey, Hamilton High School, Los Angeles, California.
I'm pretty sure it was plagiarism because I've heard the same thing growing up as well. And I'm pretty sure he wasn't my teacher.
Yeah, well, it was one of those things which it left an impression on me. But honestly, I've always worried that when the case came down to the end and I had to sum up to the jury, which is what we call argument at the end, not the summing up that the judges do in the UK, I would be so far down the chute that I would have nothing to say, you know, blah, 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 something like that. But I found over the 56 years that I practiced law, boy, that it seems like it's gone in an instant, but it's been a long time. I've never been in that position. And there's always a saving, something that you can say that's important for your client. And again, you always have to remember, it's not you, it's your client. And to me, I've always seen that as the real why I do it. It's because of the clients.
Yeah. So a lot of your cases back then were criminal, but I know you've also represented clients on death penalties.
I had one death penalty case, and I did that mainly because I did it pro bono with another lawyer. We decided we wanted to do this kind of a case. It was horrific murder, double murder. Was done for no reasons that anybody could tell, other than the prosecutor called it, they were out sport hunting by shooting two women. And it was pretty horrific. But we felt like And this was a long established principle in both of our countries that no matter how serious the crime is, how awful it might be, anybody deserves a defense. In this case, our only real defense was that you should not put him to death, that what he did was horrific, but you should not put him to death. And I can tell you that we did something that I'm not certain is, I'm certain is actually not done in the UK, because you don't have the voir dire that we have in terms of jury selection. But there's a whole cottage industry of very smart PhDs in psychology and communication skills that do jury consultancies. They help you select that jury. And so, and then they, everybody is, they help you with the focus group, and they help you with how to, you know, what kinds of issues you ought to bring up to a juror as you're asking individual questions. I remember that we had, they had graded out this one woman in this case as the highest, the best defense juror that we could get, if there's such a thing as a defense juror. Mm-hmm. And particularly in this case, there might never have been such a juror. At any rate, we only had 20 challenges. Not only, that's a lot of challenges. And these are challenges where you don't need any cause. They're called peremptory challenges, and you can simply use them to knock someone off. There is a principle that says that if you don't use all of your challenges, you cannot challenge that, you cannot raise on appeal the issue of jury selection and anyone being improperly impaneled. So we got down to 19, and we were desperate to keep this woman on, and we thought that if we used our 20th challenge, the prosecutor, who still had one or two left, was going to knock her off. So we made the decision, explained to our client what we were doing. We needed to keep her on. Well, we did. We kept her on. And I will tell you, Bill, that when I was arguing for this man's life, this woman was looking at me like, "Mr. Beagle, I think you're just as low down as your client." She was the one juror that I had completely lost eye contact with, who had completely lost any sense of empathy. And I remember, you can obviously tell, we lost that case. He was sentenced to death. She did come to the sentencing hearing. She wanted to make sure the judge did not overrule the jury and nullify their findings of death. But of course, now in the modern world and in California, our client is sitting on death row in San Quentin, California, and has not, and that was 25 years ago, and there's no death penalties, no death sentences actually imposed in California now. Mm. So until that changes, he'll be still alive.
And that's in contrast to other parts of the states, isn't it, where there's been a number of, I don't want to get sidetracked, but there's been a number of states that have started, that restarted it, which is, it's an incredible thing to think in a modern society that we do that. I used to sort of, I think as a younger lawyer, see the death penalty as one of those things that existed. But as I've got older, I've come very much to the conclusion that it's just not the right way to go. But it's very a controversial. We'll move on. So you do a lot of civil work as well. And so that must be quite different, particularly in California. So do you see, have you done sort of class actions, which are, we get the impression from all these films and books and everything else, and that class actions are more common. Do you think they're more common in California?
I'm not certain that California leads the nation in class action suits. They're all over. I have not ever done those. We're a small law firm. We really pride ourselves in just doing litigation. But when you do class action work, it's a different completely different atmosphere. And you need all sorts of different kinds of staff to reach out to the class members and to do all the things that are necessary. And we're just not equipped to do that. We do, Bill, a lot of very, I think, important work in personal injury law. I believe that anytime someone is injured by the negligence of someone else, or particularly by a public entity, that a jury's verdict winds up being a loud signal to that entity, for example, to make changes because to do otherwise would be very costly. All right. To give you a couple of examples. We're just now concluding a case, and you may find this hard to believe, but I think it's illustrative of the law, the state of the law today, that we were representing a young man who was a second-year student at a local university, living in the fourth floor of a dormitory on that campus. A very average young man, a lovely human being. But in this particular evening, he went out and made, at least for him now, the worst mistake in his life, which was imbibing from a vape containing cannabis. He had never done cannabis before, and he had a horrific response to it. I mean, he believed he was dying. He had pain in his chest such that he thought it was only a matter of time that he was going to die. He went back to his dorm, contacted his roommate, and said, "Please call 911. I'm dying." The roommate tried some homemade remedies of sit down. We'll meditate about this. Ultimately, he was so desperate to stop the pain. And you have to understand, this is what a panic attack is all about. He went to the common area of the dorm and went out, leapt out a fourth story window. Amazingly, he didn't die, but he landed on his back four stories below his room in a dirt area. And so rather than dying, he wound up being tragically a paraplegic. And I don't think, you know, people think of paraplegia as, well, you lose the limbs. You're not able to walk. Mm. Yes, that's true. He's in a wheelchair. But as his father and his mother have told me so often, you have to understand all the other things that happen when you're a paraplegic, all the things in your body that you took for granted that don't work anymore. And so, well, you would think, well, wait a second, how could the university have any, or anybody else, be responsible for an act of that was so irresponsible by this young man? Well, we took that case because we asked ourselves, wait a second, why would a fourth story floor window in a university dormitory be wide open? Because any hotels that we've ever gone to, when you're multi-story buildings, they have restrictors. If they open at all, they would only open 4 inches. So we filed that case. We did it and began discovery. And what did we learn in discovery? You get all these documents. We went back to when the dorm was built, which was in 2004, and found that the fire inspector, before giving a certificate of occupancy for the building, said, "Oh no, you cannot have open windows because," and this was her language, she said, "because students will either be show-offs and maybe hang out a window to, you know, because they're immature, or they'll be inebriated and do something stupid." And that's exactly what happened in this case. So it turns out that we were set for trial. Actually set for trial earlier this month in August. After all of, we had 14 depositions, all of the doctors, all of the treaters, everybody, the defense, of course, took the position that, wait a second, this is not our responsibility. And if it is, there's something called comparative fault, and you're going to be docked.
We have it contributory negligence.
Right.
Yeah, well, same thing.
And we did have contributory, and I think that's a good point. We had contributory negligence, but if in California, if you were contributorily negligent, you lost. You got zero. Okay. In comparative negligence, what happens is you get, if you're able to persuade the trier of fact that the public entity in this case did something wrong, was negligent, okay, which we believe is absolutely true, then whatever the jury or the trier of fact will make a determination, what percentage of fault is the university and what percentage of fault binds the plaintiff. And so if you get a $100,000 verdict,
gets split.
And you're 50% responsible, the net to you is $50,000, just as an example. This case was settled for $7.5 million, and it was settled even though we had a life care plan that suggested that it was probably going to cost, in today's dollars, about $16 million for his future needs. We were mindful of what a jury might do in terms of docking our client for comparative negligence. On the other hand, the university was very worried about, how high is this number going to go, even if there is comparative negligence? So it was, we had a very, very good mediator who brought the parties together. We worked very hard for a day. Ultimately, we were able to resolve the case.
Well, I think that's a great example of showing your passion for the law, and you're an interesting comparison. We're more alike than we realize, because I hadn't realized till doing some research that, and as you've mentioned, your wife was also a defense attorney. My wife is also a lawyer, but she's commercial real estate. How have you coped over the years with you both being in the industry, and when you come home? So I come home and I basically bring my work with me in my head, and I don't, like you, I don't stop talking. I don't stop talking about the work and everything else. And my wife has to say sort of basically enough. What's the sort of balance between you and your wife when you were both?
Well, I've been practicing law a lot longer than she has, and I try not to let her forget that. She's my partner in the law firm. Someone asked me, well, wait a second, why did you make her a partner so quickly? And I said, well, wait a second, do you know the community property law in California? She was a partner before she ever became a lawyer. But we're both very competitive people. And so we do talk about our cases a lot. And oftentimes it becomes a passionate argument. But we've been married many, many years, so we can survive those kinds of issues. And she's very talented. She was, in her very earliest professional life, was a social worker. And what she brings to our firm is I don't want to say she's not a social worker, but she brings ideas of psychology and how do we better serve this client? We say, for example, let's talk about substance abuse cases. She does mostly criminal work. That's her passion. She has cases where people are addicted, where people have psychological problems. And we've kind of coined the phrase, we don't want to be your next lawyer. We want to be your last lawyer. We want to do some proactive things, not just in the courtroom, not just with the probation department, not just trying to convince a judge to go a little bit less harsh on our client. We want the client to come out of this on the other end with some differences in their lives. And obviously, that sounds very highfalutin, but we really do want to use this experience for the client to help them get better.
I think that's a fantastic thing to do. And yeah, people are very quick, not say on that example you gave, but certainly in civil, they're very quick to keep going back to their lawyers and moan about fees. And yet, I always say to clients, you know, I didn't make you come to us. You know, they choose. And yet the clients you're talking about, that addiction is something that almost, as you say, is preventative of them breaking that cycle of offence and coming back. And if you can do that, then you've achieved far more than just being a lawyer, haven't you?
We look at it, I think, in a holistic sort of way. I can say this to you from my own background. When I was a kid, I was always saying to my parents and anyone who would listen, I want to be a doctor. And I think my sense of that was you were a healer. You were somebody who could make differences for people. Well, when I quickly learned, going back to high school again, when I took this chemistry class, it wasn't going to happen for me. I had so much trouble in those days with a slide rule. There was no Texas Instrument or no computers that were able to work on some of those chemical problems. And so I quickly shifted gears. And I do see the practice of law as being healing in way, and including not just civil, not just criminal, but civil. We deal with a lot of cases where people are very upset. They've been hurt. They're very upset. Their lives have been turned upside down. And to be able to try to deal with that and try to get them into a more positive frame of mind by the work that you're doing for them, by your dedication to them, that's going to make a difference. And we try to do that. I mean, it's not anything that we set out consciously, okay, on Tuesday, we're going to do this. It's just the way we try to operate.
I think, again, it's a good point, because people invariably want their proverbial day in court, but it's explaining to them the time and length and stress and everything that goes into that. And that mediation, for example, is a very, very strong and good alternative, because you have the opportunity to make an address to the other side. You have the opportunity to have sort of those meetings during the day, but without all the attendant extra cost and time involved. But you're quite right. It's hard to satisfy demands of parties who feel really aggrieved, but the whole process keeps a client quite distant. So you've shown your passion, and we'll come now round to your love for the UK and particularly London, because that actually started from you being in a totally different country, didn't it? You're actually on holiday in Scotland.
Yes, we were. We were at absolutely, you reminded me, we were at a wedding. I love destination weddings. They are really,
I'm open for any of them. If anyone's listening, please invite me to a destination wedding.
Yeah, well, I mean, this was one of the first I'd ever gone to, but let's just say that they wanted to get married in a castle in Scotland. We were delighted for that, but anybody who attended, it was, let's just say, it was a pocketbook challenge. At any rate, we went to the wedding, my wife and my son and myself, one of my two sons. And in coming back, we were going to fly out of Heathrow, but we had one day in London. So this was a seminal day for me, because my wife and Jacob, our younger son, they decided they wanted to go to the Tower of London. That's okay. I always had wanted to go to the Old Bailey, because I knew of its history, and I knew that the sausage was made at the Old Bailey. It was really, that's where it was done. And so I went there, and I was observing, you know, up on that second deck where the observations are in the courtrooms. And watched a trial, a murder trial, and I was so taken by the advocacy of both the prosecutor and the defense attorney. I call it erudition. They talk differently than we do in the States. I'm a little bit more colloquial. I try to be a little bit even funny. My wife claims that's not going to happen, but I try. But I try to put people at ease. At any rate, none of that. This was all business all the time, and they were terrific, and it left a huge impression on me. When I came back, I learned that there was a program that the California Lawyers Association, in those days it was the State Bar of California, but had been going on for many years. It was called A Week in Legal London. And I signed up for the program, came to London, and the program was essentially going to bring us into courtrooms. We were going to meet barristers. We were going to meet judges. We were going to meet solicitors. We were going to see how that sausage was made in another country, actually the country from which we derive a great deal of our jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. And so I wound up, I could not wait to be on the group that went to the Old Bailey. And I was, in my group, we were in a murder trial in the morning. I'll never forget, the defense lawyer was Baroness Helena Kennedy, who is, I think, a venerable defense lawyer in the UK. And I was so impressed by what I was watching. At lunchtime, we were invited to go up to the fifth floor to the barrister's mess. And I think you may know about that place. If you've not been there, the food is not terrific, but the companionship is amazing. And as we went through it's a cafeteria type line. And as I finished, I was looking around, and all the California lawyers that I was with, they were over sitting at a table alone. And I could, I talked to those people all the time. And then I looked and saw that the barristers and their solicitors who were in these murder cases were all sitting together at another table. That was an easy choice. I just sauntered over, sat down, and I said, "Hey, my name's Larry Beagle. I'm a lawyer from California. Could I join you?" Oh, the welcome mat was out. And we began talking, and I was so interested. The bottom line is, after lunch, I went back to watch Baroness Kennedy do her magic. And all of a sudden, as we were just starting that again, a fella tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Mr. Beagle, Judge Barker would like to see you in chambers." I've told this story many times, but it never gets old for me. Yeah. And so I, of course, in my mind, Bill, I thought, who did I, can I say it, piss off? Yeah. I guess this is a podcast. You can do that. And I figured I must have made some terrible faux pas. Bottom line is, I accompanied him, went to chambers, and met Brian Barker, who I will tell you, and I think you know, is truly one of the most remarkable individuals and one of the great judges I've ever met. And anyway, he was very welcoming, and he said, "I understand you're a lawyer in California, that you do crimes, amongst other things." And he said, "Mr. Beagle, if you would like, you could sit in my courtroom. We have a murder trial going right now. You could sit at counsel table." So I go,
"Well, hey,
wait a second." Oh, this was an unbelievable opportunity. So I checked with my group leader, and, "Oh, sure, you go do it." So the next thing I did, I was sitting at the defense table with a gentleman, a QC at the time, barrister by the name of Andrew Bright, who later became a very distinguished circuit judge, the resident judge out at St. Albans, the Crown Court out there. At any rate, he's defending this gentleman who had run over his girlfriend with her own Mercedes. So I've coined that case "Murder by Mercedes." But at any rate, I went out to the Starbucks with him, or the coffee. We talked about the case. I tried to give them my ideas, which were probably lame, but I was actively participating in the process. I learned that when the judge came in and when the jury came in, you bow. So mm-hmm. I was not asked to wear a wig or put on a gown. However, a local Monterey County judge where I practice saw a picture of me at Eves and Ravenscraft sporting a wig, you know, just trying it on, and said, "Larry, you know, I think it does a lot for your hairline." So at any rate, that spawned a 22-year interest and love for this program, A Legal Week in London. It spawned a lifelong relationship with Brian Barker and his family. I cannot tell you how much I admire that man. In fact, and you and I know that the tragedy of Paul Darling's passing. But through that, I met Peter Coulson, and I met, of course, Camilla Darling, Brian's daughter. And I've been very active in something here in Monterey County, which is kind of world famous in a sense. It's called the Big Sur International Marathon. It's 26 miles running right along the Pacific Coast. What did I find out? That Camilla is a marathoner. So it turned out that Brian and Camilla came out to Carmel, and she ran the marathon, and Brian and I did an ancillary program called the 11-mile walk, which is right along the Pacific Ocean for 11 miles, right in the middle of the marathon. And I can't tell you how delighted I was that they made that trip, but it shows, in a sense, the kind of relationships that one makes when you meet your brethren and brothers and sisters in the law by you know, participating in this kind of a program. It meeting people like yourself, meeting so many of the other really wonderful members of the legal community in the UK. And now we're going to, in our upcoming trip in 2026, we're going to make an add-on trip to Dublin. And we had just come back from Dublin, meeting people there and trying to set up programs where we could a network and get our participants understanding the differences and similarities between our two systems of justice and administration.
And I think your relationship shows that it transcends, you know, where you're from and backgrounds and all these things. And as you say, that's that degree of reciprocity, isn't it? The fact that you've invested and you've got Camilla to do the marathon and Brian to do the walk. And it's a lovely, it's a real engagement. So we had the meeting with Lord Justice Peter Coulson. It's very bizarre for me to be sitting in a room with Lord Justice Coulson and him saying, "Just call me Peter." It's like, really, I'd love to do that, but I'm just really feel uncomfortable about calling, you know, someone who I still think of up here. Is just, but the fact that, you know, we've had these chats about how we're going to arrange the moot for next year, and I think that's got sort of cross in support, because that's important where it's held, and it's a different inn from Peter's. But I do love, as you say, the camaraderie that it creates, and it shows that, you know, I think I'm completely bastardizing a saying, but our differences are actually don't matter. You find the bits that are similar, and our interest is in law, in development of the law, and in people. And fundamentally, law, I think, is about relationship with other lawyers and barristers and the judges and your clients. And it's how all of us act together. And yeah, I think it's been a truly lovely, although so far for me limited, much as I love London, limited experience. But I think there's so much to be gained from doing this, as I've said. And I hope that there's an opportunity, you know, as I said to you, to come out to California and sort of reciprocate in terms of telling your lawyers, you know, how our sort of law works and how, you know, our common law and how we have some of our, you know, in construction or other things, because the approaches are still very different. You know, you can go into court and represent your client. We use counsel. Counsel have, counsel and solicitors have different gowns in this country. Only counsel wear wigs, and there's still a very different view of judges between counsel, solicitors. You know, counsel sit on the front bench, we sit two benches back. It's all changed a bit with virtual hearings. But I think the programme that you're part of is a huge catalyst, is that the right word, to encourage, you know, the building of, you know, relationships, isn't it?
Well, it's not only relationships. I think it's a sense of what the law is and how it's developed. I mean, if you, I remember when I was in law school, I remembered starstruck fellow classmates of mine saying the famous words, "I love the law." Well, I don't know about loving the law, but I love the process by which the law is utilized, imposed, changed because of lawyers, because of courageous judges. I mean, we have so many examples, and you do too in your jurisdiction, of important changes in society that were made because courageous lawyers and courageous judges saw those changes as absolutely necessary. In our jurisdiction, of course, we're guided by something, by a real constitution, that is a written constitution. In the UK, you similarly have a constitution, but it's not written. It's been developed over centuries. As you watch things, as you watch in our country, for example, just going back, Gideon versus Wainwright, the idea that every criminal defendant, no matter who he or she might be, deserves counsel at trial. You cannot put these people out there and assume that because they don't have any money, they'll be okay with whatever the state does. It's ridiculous. And it seems, you know, very silly that we ever had to have that case, but that case changed society. Brown versus Board of Education changed the way where education was dealt
was provided
with racially in this country, and on and on and on. And again, there are new, all kinds of new issues that come up. The moot that we've done a couple of years ago, we did a moot where we used the template of the Asher's bakery case, which involved a bakery owner saying he would not or she would not bake a cake for a gay couple.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
And we had a very similar case in the United States, Masterpiece Cake Company. The point was, we had two excellent barristers arguing in that moot against two excellent American lawyers, not barristers, but lawyers, trial lawyers. And they argued, and it was memorable because, number one, this was a was a case where you could, both sides have plenty to say, okay? And so what it showed me was, though you speak differently in British courtrooms, the passion, the articulation, and the way things are ultimately argued are very, very much the same. And so what you're talking about with Lord Justice Colson, just to be out front, is the fact that we've recruited him and you and other people to be in a moot that we're going to do next April in 2026, at a lovely venue at the Inner Temple, right? It's going to model after the Tate Modern case, which is a construction/nuisance case. And there's, and believe me, by the way, we're just to give you a little bit of spice to this, the kind of sense of what we're trying to build in that case is there's going to be a New York developer who had some ideas later in his life he wanted to run for president, but
he was a developer who
came to the UK, purchased land to build a building on right in the middle of a relatively quiet neighborhood. And so that spawns some litigation that is going to, let's say, rely on some of the law, some of the logic that was used by your Supreme Court in the Tate Modern case.
But as you say, it also affords the opportunity of both sides of the pond's advocates to really have a lot of leeway in how they present. And I think it's, to me, it's about there's always something you can learn from other people. It might be about presentation skills. It might be about delivery. And I think it's something that is sometimes forgotten about how important it is for, you know, English lawyers to see and mix and do things with lawyers from other jurisdictions, because we can learn things. Or even if it's something you suddenly think, well, I've been doing this, but actually it's not as good a way as the other, a different way. And it's the development. But again, it shows that our laws are different, but they're comparable enough to be able to have a moot. And I know that you're interviewing or testing people who are hoping to represent California in the moot next year. I think it's I'm looking forward to it. And I think obviously there's still a lot of work for us all to do to get it ready, but I think it will be, you know, I think it will be a really good event, very interesting. And I hope that everybody comes over, gets excited about it and sees it as it's a bit of theatre, it's a bit of fun, but there's enough a degree of seriousness. And then, as you say, you've got Dublin as well. And it again showed that the introductions that, you know, we made were made for you. Everybody, when you give people the opportunity, wants to be involved, don't they? They want to help. They want to have that, build those sort of relationships. And I think that's in a world when every time you open the newspaper, you think, oh, it becomes very sort of depressing. I think it's uplifting when you have, you know, this sort of thing that is just a very positive experience.
The lawyers who've come back, who've made the trek from California to London and the environs, have been uniformly excited about what they saw, who they met. And again, going, really returning in a sense to the roots. When we went to law school, we were exposed to a great deal of British law, Blackstone's commentaries. How law in California developed is not just through our Supreme Court. It is literally, some of it comes from long-held principles starting in the UK. And as we've changed, and as we've moved away from a principle or two, we've seen that the UK has maybe adopted that change. Mm. So it's flexible. The law is a living thing. While we have a written constitution, it's all in the interpretation. And God knows that is being discussed every day of the week in the United States.
Isn't it just? And it'll also be good because I think, as we mentioned just before we sort of came on air, I think there's other things for you to make sure we fit in. It's like we need to make sure that you and your colleagues do actually spend some time going around St. Paul's. You can go onto the tower at the top of St. Paul's, and the view there of the city, you know, that was somehow miraculously during the war, St. Paul's was never hit. And the view from there is the view that you'll have had for the last, I don't know, 150, 200 years across the city. And it's a stunning view. But there's things like that, showing you and your colleagues the law and how the city has changed and grown. Those are things I'm greatly looking forward to, you know, sharing with you all.
Bill, if that's an invitation, that is accepted without any condition.
Oh yeah, I mean we'll sort out lots. I mean, as we get nearer to the time, we'll get your timetable fixed, and we'll make sure that you are all thoroughly entertained and educated. And I'm also very keen to see in April. April, you could still fit in a football game for those interested. Because, you know, again, our football is completely different from yours, but you do now have soccer. And I think, again, it's just different, but they're sports. And I think there's a lot of things that we can all enjoy. I've loved speaking to you, Larry. It's, you know, I'm sorry that we haven't seen each other online or in person for a couple of months. I'm looking forward to you coming over in April. As I say, there's a standing offer from me to come over and do a reverse sort of trip to talk to your lawyers about what it's like being a solicitor in this country, because I think it was probably unfair to say you can, you know, qualify as a solicitor in England. I've looked at the California bar. I'm very tempted to do it just to prove my brain's not dead, but it looks very difficult.
Well, Bill, let me just say that invitation is out there, and for you, we're going to call that a week in legal California.
Well, a long weekend, but perhaps a week. But it's been great, and thank you for giving up the time to come on the podcast. I know it's very early for you. I didn't even get time to tell people that, you know, you're a survivor. You walk 5 miles a day. You look great. You're a vivacious guy and just so warm-hearted and generous in your support of people. It's really appreciated. And that's why you achieve so much. But thanks. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And I hope to see you again in person, you know, very, very soon.
Well, I listen to podcasts all the time on my walks. This is the first time I've actually ever been involved in one. It's been my pleasure, Bill. Thanks so much for the invitation.
You've been a great guest. I would never know it's just your first. There you are. You're a master. Larry, thanks so much. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you for joining me for today's Barton Legal podcast. Please make sure you follow the show in your podcast app to get new episodes as soon as they're released. We'll be tackling another important topic in this month's Barton Legal webinar, and you can register for free and watch back our previous webinars at bartonlegal.com. Why don't you connect with me on LinkedIn and follow Barton Legal to keep up to date with all the legal trends and news? I look forward to speaking to you again in the next Barton Legal podcast.